Falk by Joseph Conrad. Falk, a reminiscence. Several of us, all more or less connected with the sea, were dining in a small river hostelry not more than 30 miles from London, and less than 20 from that shallow and dangerous puddle to which our coasting men give the grandiose name of Erman Ocean. And through the wide windows we had a view of the Thames, an enfilading view down the lower Hope Reach. But the dinner was execrable, and all the feast was for the eyes. That flavor of salt water which for so many of us had been the very water of life permeated our talk. He who hath known the bitterness of the ocean shall have its taste forever in his mouth. But one or two of us, pampered by the life of the land, complained of hunger. It was impossible to swallow any of that stuff. And indeed there was a strange mustiness in everything. The wooden dining room stuck out over the mud of the shore like a lacustrine dwelling. The planks of the floor seemed rotten. A decrepit old waiter tottered pathetically to and fro before an antediluvian and worm-eaten sideboard. The chipped plates might have been disinterred from some kitchen midden near an inhabited lake, and the chops recalled times more ancient still. They brought forcibly to one's mind the night of ages when the primeval man, evolving the first rudiments of cookery from his dim consciousness, scorched lumps of flesh at a fire of sticks in the company of other good fellows, then, gorged and happy, sat him back among the gnawed bones, to tell his artless tales of experience, the tales of hunger and hunt and of women, perhaps. But luckily the wine happened to be as old as the waiter. So, comparatively empty, but upon the whole fairly happy, we sat back and told our artless tales. We talked of the sea and all its works. The sea never changes, and its works for all the talk of men are wrapped in mystery. But we agreed that the times were changed. And we talked of old ships, of sea accidents, of breakdowns, dismastings, and of a man who brought his ship safe to Liverpool all the way from the River Platte under a jury rudder. We talked of wrecks, of short wrought irons, and of heroism, or at least of what the newspapers would have called heroism at sea, a manifestation of virtues quite different from the heroism of primitive times. And now and then, falling silent altogether, we gazed at the sights of the river. A P&O boat passed bound down. "Nee gets jolly good dinners on board these ships," remarked one of our band. A man with sharp eyes read out the name on her bows. "Arcadia. Had a boat I full model of a ship," murmured some of us. "She was followed by a small cargo steamer, and the flag they hauled down aboard while we were looking showed her to be a Norwegian. She made an awful lot of smoke, and before it had quite blown away, a high-sided, short, wooden bark, in ballast and towed by a paddle tug, appeared in front of the windows. All her hands were forward busy setting up the headgear, and aft a woman in a red hood, quite alone with the man at the wheel, paced the length of the poop back and forth, with the gray wool of some knitting work in her hands. "German, I should think," muttered one. "He skipper as his wife on board," remarked another, and the light of the crimson sunset all ablaze behind the London smoke, throwing a glow of Bengal light upon the bark's spars, faded away from the Hope Reach. Then one of us, who had not spoken before, a man of over 50, that had commanded ships for a quarter of a century, looking after the bark now gliding far away, all black on the luster of the river, said, "This reminds me of an absurd episode in my life, now many years ago, when I got first the command of an iron bark, loading then in a certain eastern seaport. It was also the capital of an eastern kingdom, lying up a river as might be London lies up this old Thames of ours. No more need be said of the place, for this sort of thing might have happened anywhere where there are ships, skippers, tugboats, and orphan nieces of indescribable splendour. And the absurdity of the episode concerns only me, my enemy Falk, and my friend Herman." There seemed to be something like peculiar emphasis on the words, "why friend Herman," which caused one of us, for we had just been speaking of heroism at sea, to say idly and nonchalantly, "And was this Herman a hero?" "Not at all," said our grizzled friend. "No hero at all. He was a chauffeur. Ship conductor. That's how they call a master mariner in Germany. I prefer our way. The alliteration is good, and there is something in the nomenclature that gives to us as a body the sense of corporate existence. Apprentice, mate, master, in the ancient and honorable craft of the sea. As to my friend Herman, he might have been a consummate master of the honorable craft, but he was called officially chauffeur, and had the simple heavy appearance of a well-to-do farmer, combined with the good-natured shrewdness of a small shopkeeper. With his shaven chin, round limbs, and heavy eyelids, he did not look like a toiler, and even less like an adventurer of the sea. Still, he toiled upon the seas, in his own way, much as a shopkeeper works behind his counter. And his ship was the means by which he maintained his growing family. She was a heavy, strong, blunt-bowed affair, awakening the ideas of primitive solidity, like the wooden plow of our forefathers. And there were, about her, other suggestions of a rustic and homely nature. The extraordinary timber projections which I have seen in no other vessel made her square stern resemble the tail end of a miller's wagon. But the four stern ports of her cabin, glazed with six little greenish panes each, and framed in wooden sashes painted brown, might have been the windows of a cottage in the country. The tiny white curtains and the greenery of flower pots behind the glass completed the resemblance. On one or two occasions, when passing under stern, I had detected from my boat a round arm in the act of tilting a watering pot, and the bowed sleek head of a maiden whom I shall always call Herman's niece, because as a matter of fact I've never heard her name, for all my intimacy with the family. This, however, sprang up later on. Meantime, in common with the rest of the shipping in that eastern port, I was left in no doubt, as to Herman's, no tie-ins of hygienic clothing. Evidently he believed in wearing good stout flannel next his skin. On most days little frocks and pinafores could be seen drying in the mizzen rigging of his ship, or a tiny row of socks fluttering on the signal halyards. But once a fortnight the family washing was exhibited in force. It covered the poop entirely. The afternoon breeze would incite to a weird and flabby act of idy all that crowded mass of clothing, with its vague suggestions of drowned, mutilated and flattened humanity. Trunks without heads waved at you, arms without hands, legs without feet kicked fantastically with collapsible flourishes, and there were long white garments that, taking the wind fairly through their neck openings etched with lace, became for a moment violently distended, as by the passage of obese and invisible bodies. On these days you could make out that ship at a great distance by the multicolored grotesque riot going on abaft her mizzen mast. She had her berth just ahead of me, and her name was Diana, Diana not of Ephesus but of Bremen. This was proclaimed in white letters a foot long spaced widely across the stern, somewhat like the lettering of a shop sign, under the cottage windows. This ridiculously unsuitable name struck one as an impertinence towards the memory of the most charming of goddesses. For, apart from the fact that the old craft was physically incapable of engaging in any sort of chase, there was a gang of four children belonging to her. They peeped over the rail at passing boats, and occasionally dropped various objects into them. Thus, sometime before I knew Herman to speak to, I received on my head a horrid rag doll belonging to Herman's eldest daughter. However, these youngsters were upon the whole well behaved. They had fair heads, round eyes, round little knobby noses, and they resembled their father a good deal. This Diana of Bremen was a most innocent old ship, and seemed to know nothing of the wicked sea, as there are on shore households that know nothing of the corrupt world. And the sentiments she suggested were unexceptionable, and mainly of a domestic order. She was a home. All these dear children had learned to walk on her roomy quarter deck. In such thoughts there is something pretty, even touching. Their teeth, I should judge, they had cut on the ends of her running gear. I have many times observed the baby Herman, Nicholas, engaged in gnawing the whipping of the fore royal brace. Nicholas's favorite place of residence was under the main fife rail. directly he was let loose, he would crawl out there, and the first seaman who came along would bring him, carefully held aloft in hairy hands, back to the cabin door. I fancy there must have been a standing order to that effect. In the course of these transportations, the baby, who was the only peppery person in the ship, tried to smite these stalwart young German sailors on the face. Mrs. Herman, an engaging, stout housewife, wore on board baggy blue dresses with white dots. When, as happened once or twice, I caught her in an elegant little washtub rubbing hard on white collars, baby socks, and Herman's summer neckties, she would blush in girlish confusion, and raising her wet hands greet me from afar with many friendly nods. Her sleeves would be rolled up to the elbows, and the gold hoop of her wedding ring glittered among the soapsuits. Her voice was pleasant, as he had a serene brow, smooth bands of very fair hair, and a good-humored expression of the eyes. She was motherly, and moderately talkative. When this simple matron smiled, youthful dimples broke out on her fresh broad cheeks. Her man's niece on the other hand, an orphan and very silent, I never saw attempt a smile. This, however, was not gloom on her part, but the restraint of youthful gravity. They had carried her about with them for the last 3 years, to help with the children, and be company for Mrs. Herman, as Herman meant I and once to me. It had been very necessary while they were all little, he had added in a vexed manner. It was her arm and her sleek head, that I had glimpsed one morning, through the stern windows of the cabin, hovering over the pots of fuchsias and mignonette. But the first time I beheld her full length I surrendered to her proportions. They fix her in my mind, as great beauty, great intelligence, quickness of wit or kindness of heart might have made some or other woman equally memorable. With her it was form and size. It was her physical personality that had this imposing charm. She might have been witty, intelligent, and kind to an exceptional degree. I don't know, and this is not to the point. All I know is that she was built on a magnificent scale. Built is the only word. She was constructed, she was erected, as it were, with a regal lavishness. It staggered you to see this reckless expenditure of material upon a chit of a girl. She was youthful, and also perfectly mature, as though as he had been some fortunate immortal. She was heavy too, perhaps, but that's nothing. It only added to that notion of permanence. She was barely 19. But such shoulders, such round arms, such a shadowing forth of mighty limbs, when with three long strides she pounced across the deck upon the overturned Nicholas, it's perfectly indescribable. She seemed a good, quiet girl, vigilant, as to Lena's needs, Gustav's tumbles, the state of Carl's dear little nose, conscientious, hard-working, and all that. But what magnificent hair she had! Abundant, long, thick, of a tawny color. It had the sheen of precious metals. She wore it plaited tightly into one single tress hanging girlishly down her back, and its end reached down to her waist. The massiveness of it surprised you. On my word, it reminded one of a club. Her face was big, comely, of an unruffled expression. She had a good complexion, and her blue eyes were so pale that she appeared to look at the world with the empty white candor of a statue. You could not call her good-looking. It was something much more impressive. The simplicity of her apparel, the opulence of her form, her imposing stature, and the extraordinary sense of vigorous life that seemed to emanate from her like a perfume exhaled by a flower, made her beautiful with a beauty of a rustic and Olympian order. To watch her reaching up to the clothesline with both arms raised high above her head, caused you to fall a-musing in a strain of pagan piety. Excellent Mrs. Herman's baggy cotton gowns had some sort of rudimentary frills at neck and bottom, but this girl's print frocks hadn't even a wrinkle. Nothing but a few straight folds in the skirt falling to her feet, and these, when she stood still, had a severe and statuesque quality. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.